I'm Mindy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Addiction and overdose are among the most serious social and health issues facing our country today. Just this week, Attorney General Jeff Sessions called drug overdose deaths the top lethal issue in the U.S., with preliminary data showing nearly 60,000 overdose deaths in the U.S. in 2016. With overdose deaths rising and friends and loved ones battling addiction, it's not uncommon to feel helpless and hopeless. What can be done to slow and stop this epidemic? Today, we focus on hope in the face of addiction and substance use. Later in the hour, we discuss a new program model designed to immediately connect individuals and families with substance use treatment, counseling, and education. But first, a mother tells us the story of her son's addiction and subsequent recovery. Lisa Hillman joins us. She's the author of Secret No More, a true story of hope for parents with an addicted child. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Mindy. Nice to be here.
So tell us a little bit about your family before we get into the story.
So I have what one might consider a quote-unquote normal, does anyone, family. A husband. We've been married. We're newlyweds. We've been married 49 years. We have a grown daughter. She's 43, married to a Navy guy. I have an nine-year-old grandson and a son who's 28. My daughter and my son were born on the same day.
That's so interesting, too. And I think your daughter, if I remember the book, she said, just don't have him on my birthday.
She said on the morning of her 15th birthday, Mom, you can have that baby any day you like, just not on my birthday. And 6 hours later, she had a brother.
And they, because of their age difference, it was almost like they were each raised as only children.
Correct.
In a way. Yeah.
I raised two only children.
Right. Now, you found out that you were pregnant with Jacob, your son, just after you learned of your mother's diagnosis of inoperable lung cancer. What an emotional roller coaster that time must have been for you.
That was very strange. In fact, the Cape relates to that because I was we were here to run the Falmouth Road Race, and I learned that my mother had inoperable cancer, phoned her quite a bit during that vacation, then went home, found out I was pregnant with Jacob. Mm-hmm. I didn't know, of course, it was Jacob, but yeah. Found out I was pregnant. And then he was born 2 weeks to the day after she died.
Yeah, which was sad. She never really got to meet him. Talk about Jacob's childhood. He had a pretty good childhood.
Again, what one might consider fairly normal. Grew up, went to a private nursery school, went to a public kindergarten, went to a public school, had friends, was smart, good-looking, fun.
Popular.
Lots of friends, very popular. Got asked to be part of school plays, got asked to take leadership classes. So we assumed we're raising a normal, healthy, happy son.
Then you get a phone call from Mr. Greenfield at Jacob's High School. He's just beginning his senior year, and Mr. Greenfield is concerned because some of Jacob's friends have come to him concerned about Jacob drinking and possibly using marijuana. This floored you.
That's the call that no parent ever wants to get, and that's the call that parents do get. When I got that call, it was a late August night at the beginning of Jacob's senior year of high school. My first thought was he must have the wrong kid, not my son, not in my household. There is no addiction that we know of in my family, and I was totally shocked and unprepared for this.
Yeah. I think most parents are unprepared for it when you get that phone call. And that, it is. It's sort of that shock. And I think for a lot of parents, there's denial. Like you're saying, this can't be my son. This, you know, you just can't believe that this is happening.
So you live in denial for a while.
For a while,
because
yes.
You cannot believe it's your kid. And you kind of stuff it in the back of your mind and think, oh, that was just a strange phone call. Life will go on. I'll continue working. My husband will be working. Jacob will go to school. But then the signs start to creep up.
Right. And when you get this call, you talk to Jacob about it. And as most kids will have, they'll give you an excuse that you go, okay, that's believable. I can take that. But then you find a bong in his bedroom.
So when I found that, first of all, even though I'm an educated woman, even though I worked in a healthcare system, even though I worked in a healthcare system that had a substance abuse treatment center, I still wasn't quite sure what that thing was. My first thought was, oh, here's an elegant little thing. Where did this come from? Then I realized what it was, and I had to approach Jacob with it.
Mm-hmm. And of course, he was holding it for a friend.
So he said, this isn't mine, Mom.
Yeah,
it's a friend. It's for a friend.
Yeah. And so you throw it away in the trash, or one of you throws it away in the trash. And then when you bring the trash out, you look and you realize he's coming. He's taking it out of the trash. So now you know there's something going on. I can't remember exactly where along the way here you have him see a psychologist, which sounds like a great plan. He sees the psychologist and the psychologist tells you this is just normal behavior. Lots of kids go through this, and that reassures you somewhat. And maybe that shouldn't have.
The psychologist actually reaffirmed what I was thinking, that this is normal. All kids drink. All kids smoke. This is a phase. He's going to grow out of this. Just let it be. And again, denial, constant mm-hmm. denial.
Yeah. As I'm reading this, I'm thinking along, okay, maybe this stage will pass, right? Some kids it does. But when you find the tinfoil in his room, I was thinking, oh no, this is bad.
And of course, I didn't know what the tinfoil was. Why are there little square sheets of aluminum foil on my son's floor? What does that mean? Not only was there foil, but there was a dark smudge line up the center of the foil. And it wasn't really till years later that I realized what that was.
Right. And I guess that's one of the important things about helping educate parents about signs to look for. And that's one of the reasons you wrote the book, right? Because you didn't have that when you discovered this with your son.
Yeah, Mindy, it is one of the reasons I wrote the book. But the primary reason I wrote the book was for parents, for themselves. This is my story. It's not my son's story. It's not a story of really how of his addiction so much as it's a story of my reaction mm-hmm. to his addiction. And as you said, how I denied it and ignored it and didn't want to believe what I was seeing right in front of me.
And it's also, he's been a good kid. He's you've got a good relationship with him. He's honest with you. And even in some of the conversations you have with him about his drinking and drug use, he's somewhat honest, doesn't tell you everything. And you can see where you might say this is believable.
And you don't want to break that tenuous tie you have with your child. If you love your child and you think he's telling you the truth, you don't want to force him into a corner where he has to lie to you. So it's a game you start playing. Right. You don't question him that much.
One of the things I found really interesting throughout the story is even kind of early on, he expresses an emptiness and a pain. Now looking back in hindsight, you can go, oh gosh, I wish I had dealt with that way back then, because that was at the core really of his addiction.
But I didn't see that then.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until years later, actually, that Jacob explained to me, Mom, and this is today. Now, this is mm-hmm. recent. He says, Mom, I felt different than other kids. There was a hole inside of me. The drinking or the drugs filled that hole. Today, I say to him, what does that mean today? He said, well, if you take away the drinking or the drugs, you still have the hole. Mm-hmm. And what has to fill that hole is something else. And today for him, it's something spiritual that fills that hole.
Right. And that may be the case for a lot of kids who end up being addicted, is they're trying to fill something, some void.
They're trying to fill some void. But meanwhile, what's happening to the parent or mm-hmm. what's happening to the family? Because addiction is right. a family disease.
Right. And you write in the book, incredibly naive, lacking so much understanding. During Jacob's freshman year at Maryland, I made all the classic mistakes that parents with addicted sons and daughters make. I searched for the cause of the problem.
Thank you for picking up that passage. That's a passage that I will often share when I'm invited to talk to groups, because I did look for a cure. You know, there's the famous three C's. It took me a while to learn that I didn't cause it. I couldn't control it, nor could I cure it. So
but you were trying to do all three.
doesn't a parent? I mean, yeah. I was the mom. I was the fixer. If my son was doing something bad or wrong or sick, I was the one who had to fix it.
Right. You talk about how you learned that addiction makes a surprise around every corner. And I thought, boy, that is so true.
Just when you think you've got it licked, just when you think, gee, he's back in school, he's in community college now, living at home, he's flunked out of College Park, Maryland, but he's home, he's in community college, he's working, things look pretty normal, he's got friends, and then bam, you get hit again.
I think also one of the difficult things as a parent, teenagers often retreat to their room. They could be sullen, moody, and they're just being normal teenagers. So sometimes it's really tough when you look at those signs and you go, well, is he doing drugs? Is he not? And that was difficult for you sometimes to be able to tell what exactly was going on.
So I've since learned, and maybe this is intro a lot of kids, Jake preferred to use alone. Mm-hmm. And what I didn't know then was that he built a cave, so to speak, in his room. He bought a clunky old couch that a friend helped move in. He said, Mom, do I have permission to redo my room? This is when he was home going to community college. And I thought, well, it's his room, right? Sure, let him assemble his room so he's comfortable with it. And little did I know that he was actually building a cave where he could use.
He knew. You write in the book, you aren't prepared for what you hear either. Just like the meetings with Jacob's counselors in high school, when they tried to tell me my son wasn't doing well, I found it hard to comprehend whom they were talking about. And you sort of touched on this. But even now, as he gets into college, it's still so hard to comprehend the extent of his use.
When we took Jacob for an assessment at an outpatient treatment center, I'm sitting there thinking the counselor's going to come back and say, he's fine, or maybe he needs a little counseling. She comes back and says he needs intensive outpatient treatment. The word intensive just rocked me. Mm-hmm. My son was quote-unquote that bad that he needed intensive treatment. Still, and this was probably 2 years into his using, it still rocked me.
Yeah. And you even get, it gets worse than that. You have a counselor who tells you that he's doing some very dangerous drugs. Didn't say what those were, and you even write in the book you kind of didn't want to know.
Again, denial. Mm-hmm. Part of it is that if I had to face Jake's addiction, I wouldn't know what to do about it. Mm-hmm. Plus, at the time, I had a fairly responsible, very responsible position with a very large healthcare institution in our hometown of Annapolis. And I was ashamed. Mm-hmm. I was afraid that people would find out my son was an addict. I was afraid they'd find out he was using. I wasn't sure what that would mean and how it would reflect on me. Looking back, how selfish is that? But that's where I was. Mm-hmm. I wanted to keep this a secret.
But I think a lot of families, even to this day, they feel that they don't want people to know, because what would people think of me? What kind of a mother am I that my son is an addict? You were blaming yourself.
Totally blame myself. I must have caused this. There must be some makeup, something I did wrong. And if I couldn't raise healthy, normal kids, what does it say about me?
Yeah. Let's talk about your job for a second. You had a really big job at the hospital, and you worked long hours. You had to attend events. And that, I'm sure, added to your guilt of what, you know, not being able to be home. But you and your husband kind of, and this was, I thought, interesting, without even really talking about it, you each sort of arranged your schedules so that one of you was home when he was home.
So I did have a big job. I loved it. I was a chief fundraiser for the Anne Arundel Health System in Annapolis, Maryland. I had a board of 25 people, a staff of a dozen, raising millions of dollars every year. Talk about addicted. I was addicted to that high when the donor says yes. It was great. Wanted that again and again and again. And I loved my work, but work was a refuge. I would go to the hospital, I'd go to work, and was able to quote-unquote forget for that moment what I knew was going on in my household. Mm-hmm. So work was my refuge, except it would interfere. I'd get that phone call. Mm-hmm. A counselor would call, or my husband would call and say, Jacob needs you now. And I'd have to retreat to my office, shut the door, and face it.
And there does come a point where one of the counselors tells you that you need to tell your bosses, I guess, at that time, what's going on.
So part of the illness in families, and certainly with me, was keeping it a secret. I did not know then that keeping it a secret was actually harming me. I was suffering the same fears and emotions that the addict does. Denial, fear, isolation, shame, secrecy, all of that. And it just literally mirrored what my son was going through. I was getting so depressed that there was a moment, and I write about this in the book, when I'm at the gym thinking, well, if it gets really bad enough and I can't face the fact that my son is doing this and that he's actually killing himself, then I'll just end it. Mm. I was never really suicidal, but looking back on it, I was that depressed. And it wasn't until a counselor said to me, you've got to start telling people. You've got to tell someone. You've got to tell someone where you work about this.
Yeah. And your bosses were very supportive, which was lovely. But then they also told you, well, you need to tell somebody on your team.
So then I bring into the office one day my two senior people that work with me. And looking back on this time, they were terrific. I brought them in and said, I have a health issue in my household. I may have to leave suddenly. I need to rely on you. Both of them said, no worries, we've got your back covered, and left. They left so abruptly that I'm pretty sure, you know, it's like everybody knew what was going on. I thought no one knew, but I think a lot of people did know.
But they didn't ask you. They didn't say, well, what's the health? You know, they were
fabulous. Yeah.
You write, years later, I would realize that addiction isn't a disease anyone will face alone, and yet millions do. I think that's a really important message, because here you really felt like the only person you could talk to about it was your husband. Nobody else on the outside could know. And I'm sure there are many other families that are doing that same thing. So what would you say to them about that approach?
I'd say probably three things. Number one, recognize that you have limitations. You're not going to fix this disease. You're not going to cure it. Number two, get help for yourself. If it means telling a trusted colleague at work, and if you work, I think it is important to have someone at work you can trust, because we spend as much time at work as we do at home. And three, I would say continue to get help for yourself. My husband and I still go to Al-Anon mm-hmm. once a week. 6 years later, Jake is clean 5 years and 6 months. We still go to Al-Anon because it keeps us grounded.
I was going to say, talk about that, because I think you have a very normal reaction when you walk into that first meeting. You're like, oh boy, is there anybody here? And you actually do run into somebody that you know. And that's got to be a very scary, that first visit is kind of scary.
It took a lot of courage to walk up the steps of that church and go into that first meeting and sit there. As I'm sitting there, in walks someone I know well. A gentleman whom I've known for decades. He is astonished to see me there. I'm not as surprised to see him, because I knew there was something in his family. But Al-Anon is anonymous, and I had to trust that, and still today do trust that, mm-hmm. that my story would be safe and I would be safe. My second meeting, a board member walked in, one of my own board members. And again, at that point, I wanted to go through the floor, literally, mm-hmm. but it's anonymous. And so I felt comfortable. I felt safe. The third meeting was with a much larger group. Walked into that room. There were at least two couples there who were very close friends, and I had no idea.
Yeah. I was going to say, and we should say, you had a big, important job, but your husband was also mayor. So, I mean, you're well known around town.
We are very public people, and secrecy had no room in our lives. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was no place for it until this.
Yeah. And I must say, to the meeting, going to the Al-Anon meetings and seeing these people, it really, in a sense, does the opposite of what you think it will do. It creates a bond. So when you see these people again, you out in public, you may not discuss it, but there's probably a little look. You know, I think you and one of the guys, you kind of see each other across the room, and it's just sort of, I don't know, comfortable, I guess.
So Al-Anon begins, I think for me, began my healing. I found a very large and growing, sadly, community of people who understand, instantly understand. And as you say, there's that bond instantly. So from that point on, once I started going there and had friends in Al-Anon, even in the hospital setting, I'd walk around and suddenly there'd be someone I saw at a meeting the other night. All we had to do was look at each other, and that just made the day.
Yeah. One of the other things you learn through this process is not to have expectations.
I had to let go of so much. Here's this beautiful child, and if you see the cover of the book, you'll know what I mean.
It's a beautiful little boy, yeah.
Beautiful little boy who was born to me sort of late in life, again, 2 weeks after my mother dies. And I'm thinking, this child was sent to me. This is it. My life is made now. He's going to make me proud. He's going to go to MIT or Harvard mm-hmm. or whatever. And suddenly he's taking a totally different path. So I had to let go of expectations to the point of totally letting go of expectations, hoping only that he would be healthy. Mm-hmm. It got to a point that my only hope was let this child live and be healthy. Let go of expectations, but never of hope.
Right. I was going to say, that was one of the things I wrote down, the importance of hope. And I think we talk so much about this opioid epidemic and so many young people who lose their lives, and it's terrible, but we don't often talk about those who make it through and who are in recovery and are doing well, like your son. So it's important to tell these stories, because there is hope.
Mindy, one of the reasons I wrote the book, I wrote it first because I had to, the catharsis of writing a book. And if anyone is going through a difficult situation, journaling does help. The book was written from a journal. But I also wrote it because when I was going through it, I went to bookshelves, libraries, bookstores, Googled, aching for a book written by a parent of an addict that would give me some hope. And most of the books I found actually scared me. Mm-hmm. So as I'm writing this book, I'm thinking, gee, maybe this book will give other parents hope.
Yeah. And we should say the recovery process is tough. Jacob relapsed several times. And you, again, talk about that emotional roller coaster. You're like, oh, he's doing well. And then, oh, the
so
shoe
that's
drops,
part
yeah.
of expectations. Let it go. Don't expect that just because he's in a fancy rehab center or a non-fancy rehab center or just because he's going to AA, he's going to make it. Don't mm-hmm. expect that, but hope that he will. Mm-hmm. And then we get another fateful call. The phone becomes a real issue in addiction, but we get this other phone call on a New Year's Eve that Jacob desperately needs detox. The counselors picked him up. And I say to the admissions director at yet our third inpatient rehab, how many times do I have to pay for this? Money's an issue in addiction. And the rehab guy says to me, tell your son this is the last time. So I told him it was the last time we'd pay for it, hoping then that I meant it. And I think then I did mean it. Did that get Jacob clean? I don't know. Mm-hmm. What got him clean? I'm not sure. But he did find something in that third rehab, something that filled that hole for him. Mm-hmm. And he's been clean ever since.
Yeah. And I love the story where, and I think this was your daughter was behind this, getting rid of the couch in Jacob's room. That
was
a big deal for you.
I was at work. Jacob had gone to Florida to continue rehab. And I come home and go upstairs to his bedroom and the couch is gone. And that piece of the nightmare is gone.
Yeah. So just, I guess, if advice you would give parents who may suspect that their child is dabbling or using drugs?
I would say, you know, first of all, don't deny it. Mm-hmm. Don't live in denial. You're not helping yourself or your child. Get help, maybe even before you talk to your child. I did do that. I called our rehab center and got some language to use. What mm-hmm. do I do? So get arm yourself with as much information and support as you can, because you will need it, not just for that first conversation, but for the ones that will inevitably follow. Arm yourself with help. But approach your child and be ready to figure out what is the next step. Where do I go from here? Give your child some boundaries. Offer, if you can, to pay for help. We said to Jacob, we'll pay for your education and your medical care. That's pretty much it. Because when he was working, he had an income, but that income was going to his drugs. So that would be my advice to families.
All right. Lisa Hillman, her book is Secret No More, A True Story of Hope for Parents with an Addicted Child. Thanks so much for coming in. Thanks for writing the book.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up after a break, Drop-In Nights, a new program model to immediately connect individuals and families with substance use treatment, counseling, and education. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about hope in the face of substance use and addiction this hour. Stories of recovery, if you haven't, we'd love to hear from you. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Joining us is Gail Wilson. She's the Health and Human Services Director of the Town of Mashpee and also Chair of Mashpee's Substance Use Task Force. Welcome, Gail. Good to see you.
Good to be here.
And Jen Monahan, she's the Addiction Program Coordinator at the Community Health Center of Cape Cod. Welcome to you, Jen, as well.
Thank you for having me.
Gail, the Mashpee Substance Use Task Force came up with the idea of having substance use drop-in nights that are being held on the first Tuesday of the month at the Community Health Center in Mashpee. Tell us more about drop-in nights and where this idea came from.
So drop-in nights originated from E.B. Hope out of East Bridgewater. They came and presented to the task force about a out-of-the-box approach to treating the opioid crisis. And what became apparent to us is the need for the whole community to come together and really work together toward this crisis. And about individuals who not only need help, but also their family members. So E.B. Hope had developed a drop-in night, which they held at a local church. We also were impressed with the idea that they could get people into treatment typically within 24 hours. So along those lines, we talked about piloting a drop-in night approach in Mashpee.
So what happens when someone shows up at a drop-in night? I mean, who's there? What kinds of information or support can someone expect to find?
So typically when someone comes to drop-in night, it's a very warm and welcoming place. We have about approximately 16 drop-in night partners, which are treatment and recovery agencies all together in one place in this night. So we have volunteers from the task force that act as greeters. And as soon as someone walks in, they're immediately greeted by somebody and shown around to the different resource tables. It's a fair-like setting, and they can speak one-on-one with representatives from the different treatment and recovery agencies.
Jen, the Community Health Center offers a number of options for addiction treatment, including medically assisted treatment, or MAT. Can you describe some of the supports and services that you offer for addiction?
So our MAT, the medication-assisted treatment program, we offer two innovative medications to help support those in recovery. We use both Suboxone and Vivitrol. Along with the medication, though, we're a program. You can't just come in and get the medication. It starts with an intake appointment with a provider and a nurse. And then from there, it's a weekly appointment with a nurse for a follow-up. They see the provider very regularly. And there's also counseling. We have five different groups we offer at all three sites. We have Mashpee, Falmouth, and Bourne location. And there's groups available at different times, different days, to hopefully help support those that are working, that need, you know, hours to work around their job. We're also beginning a SOAP program, Structured Outpatient Addiction Program, which is more intensive for people that need a little bit more than the MAT program can offer, more supports, daily groups, with the hope that that will get them into different, either the MAT program or continue their recovery in a different way. We are beginning a pre-contemplative group for those who are not yet ready to be either in the MAT or SOAP program. And that's for people that they're thinking about, you know, they want to stop, they can't yet stop because the programs are so structured. It'll be like a 7-week program. They come to a group a week and go from there.
That's interesting you said. I was just thinking, you know, a lot of times, you know, when we just heard Lisa's story about how many times her son went through rehab and didn't know what that last program was, but something stuck. And a lot of times, excuse me, you need to be ready, I guess, to really, you know, be successful in your recovery. So this is, I guess, a way that you're, the way they're thinking about it, where you can seize that moment when it happens. Is that the idea?
Yes. Yep. So we're pretty much up against the drug dealers. And when people feel like, all right, they've had enough, they need something, sometimes treatment's hard to get into. But if we have a group available that they want to stop, they're not quite there, they can come to this group. And hopefully that will lead them to recovery. Mm-hmm. But it's not like they come, if they use, they're kicked out of the program.
That's not how it works.
Yeah.
So is it possible to show up at a drop-in night and be admitted to treatment that very same day?
That's our hope. We have so many different resources available and resources available by phone as well. So if one of the resources available, they don't have a bed, we can make phone calls to help get them treatment that day. Wow. Usually within 24 hours, we can get a bed.
Right. I mean, that's the really important aspect of drop-in night, that we have multiple treatment and recovery resources available to someone. So if one place doesn't have something available, there will be another place that does. And so typically someone will get into a treatment bed either that night or the next morning.
Wow, that's great, because that's been a problem for a lot of folks.
Huge problem.
Yeah. So how do you determine who might need immediate assistance like that?
So we have two clinicians on board, myself and another clinician, and Gail as well. We work together we have a private room. We'll bring the person into and do a little interview, figure out what they're doing, what their needs might be. There's so many recovery options that sometimes people can be treated outpatient. Some people do need a detox, and then we work with them and make phone calls if a bed isn't available with the resource we have available that night.
Yeah. And we might immediately think of opioid addiction, but there are other substances, obviously, that can cause addiction, such as alcohol. Can folks seek help for various addictions at the drop-in nights and the Community Health Center?
Yes. I mean, it's not limited to just opioids. As we know, sometimes multiple substances are involved. And we have agencies that will treat any of the different substances. And we also will have AA participating, and we have NA as 12-step groups also.
What about the families? You know, we're talking, you mentioned that this is also a place families can come to.
So first of all, we do have, for families coming in, We have a child care person that will be on site to actually who brings Play-Doh and coloring books. So if parents need to bring their kids, there will be someone who's qualified to watch them. And secondly, we have support groups and counseling available for families, because addiction not only affects the individual, but as we know, also affects family. And the whole point here is to really treat everyone around the person struggling.
Right. I think we heard that in Lisa's interview, where she talked about she was suffering from some of the same things her son was, the isolation, the fear, and you know how she, what did she say? You can't do this alone. Mm-hmm. So you need a team to work with you on that. We talked about the finding beds being such an issue, and we've heard many stories about people traveling to Boston or elsewhere, or not even being able to find the spot when they really need it. Is that changing? Are we seeing more beds become available, or is it still a big problem?
There's a search process definitely for beds. On a daily basis, I'll speak to people that do need more than outpatient treatment that we offer at the community health center. So we assist with making phone calls on the drop in night. We assist with trying to get them a bed from the resource available, mm-hmm. or have it within 24 hours. It is a search process, mm-hmm. though, and people in struggling with substance use disorder sometimes aren't strong enough to do it themselves. Right. So we try to support them and offer that guidance and help make the phone calls and offer the resources available.
And you know who to call.
Yes. Yeah.
That's right. A really good point, Jen, because I think what we help do is, because addiction, three important points about addiction is, number one, the person does feel very isolated. And number two, they feel maybe no one understands what they're going through. Mm-hmm. And three, that loved ones and friends feel very overwhelmed. By coming into the drop-in night, they immediately feel connected to somebody. Mm-hmm. And because it's so overwhelming, we assist them in making those calls, or they actually speak to the representatives present face-to-face about what their need is. And that's a very powerful tool.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Addiction treatment, especially inpatient, can be very expensive. What happens if someone comes in either on a drop-in night or the health center who doesn't have insurance or insurance that will cover treatment expenses?
Luckily, the community health center has a person to help guide people that don't have insurance or are having trouble if they lose their insurance. We have someone who will help be their liaison and make some phone calls. They're available for the drop-in night to help assist.
866-999-4626 is our toll-free number if you have questions or if you have a story of recovery. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about hope in the face of substance use and addiction with Gail Wilson, the Health and Human Services Director for the town of Mashpee. She's also the chair of Mashpee's Substance Use Task Force. And Jen Monahan, she's the Addiction Program Coordinator at the Community Health Center of Cape Cod. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join our conversation. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Let's talk about terminology. We hear a lot of people say substance abuse, but it's sort of evolving now to substance use. So explain the significance behind the change in language.
So addiction is one of the most stigmatized diseases. Really understanding the terminology helps to decrease the stigma. But like any mental health disorder or any health disorder, there's a learning process and learning what is appropriate and the least stigmatizing way to describe something, I guess you can say. It's a learning process, though, for everyone. And the more awareness people have and education they have on substance use disorders, the better people can understand the terminology. It takes time.
Yeah.
Right. So the newest revision of the DSM-5 no longer uses the term substance abuse and substance dependence, but rather substance use disorders, looking at it more as a chronic disease. Mm-hmm. And I think Jen's right. It's going to take time, as anything else, to solely look at the stigma associated with this, and the terminology is an important piece.
Let's talk to Miguel, who's calling us from Falmouth. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
Good. Good. I'm just coming up on 10 years clean from heroin with the drug Suboxone. And I think Suboxone, Suboxone is absolutely a miracle. Not only does it relieve the desire for heroin, and I used for 23 years.
Wow.
I really, to tell you the truth, I had given up. I really thought it was a lifetime thing. My cross to bear, so to speak. And, you know, not only does it alleviate the need for the want, the desire, but it also blocks you from feeling the effect.
Mm-hmm.
So with this Suboxone, I mean, I don't see really why it's not being sold in liquor stores. You know, if you're 21 and you can, you know, why not make it as easy as that, or yeah, in a drugstore or in the police department?
Yeah.
You know, because once these people figure out, well, you know, if I can get, because this isn't New York, you have to get more money together to get their fix.
Yeah. Miguel, first I want to say congratulations on your 10 years, and we're happy to hear that. And thank you for calling and sharing your story, because I think it's important. And 23 years, it's important for people to hear that, because as we said earlier, you feel hopeless. You feel like, you know, isolated, like he was saying, I felt like I was just going to give up. Right. And there are so many different paths that people take to recovery. Mm-hmm. And his point about it being, it is pretty, it's not available in liquor stores or pharmacies, but it is pretty available for people who want it, right?
It is. There are more and more waivered physicians, but it is a medication, and it needs to be monitored, and that's why it's not just sold in a liquor store. There's many programs that provide Suboxone, but there's also doctors you can go to and receive the prescription. It is medication, though, so it needs to be monitored and distributed appropriately.
Right, with every medication, it's not right for everyone. Right.
Correct. Yeah, there's so many different ways for recovery, and different medications available too.
Yeah. You started the drop-in nights at the beginning of the summer. What's been the response? And can you share any of the stories that you have of folks who've come?
Well, I feel it's far exceeded our expectations. Our goal initially was to help one person, if we could help one person. And it has been very successful, and we are, you know, really combating a huge long-term stigma. And so slowly people are really, really addressing this.
Mm-hmm. And has there been interest in expanding the drop-in nights to other locations to make it accessible for more people?
So our long-term goal is to regionalize the drop-in nights. So what's important to know is that anybody is welcome from any town, anywhere. And Mashpee is starting this night, but our goal is to eventually regionalize the night.
So it's across the Cape and Islands,
yes,
for everybody. So since the drop-in nights have started, have you had ideas on how to improve them or change? I mean, you sort of evolve, I guess, as you see what the needs are, but is it looking at some ways to improve it?
Each night, we find different ways. We meet the Mashpee Substance Use Committee. We have a subcommittee for the drop-in, and we meet following to discuss how we can improve it. Each night, we improve it in a different way, and the only constant is change and progression in anything. So,
yeah, we're constantly looking at, you know, what are the needs of the community, and not only in Mashpee but surrounding communities, and looking at what is, you know, what different things that we can do to improve the flow of the night. And but overall, I think the structure has been working so well. Everybody plays a role. The Mashpee Substance Use Task Force was created about a year ago, September of 2016, and everyone is extremely passionate about this. And each person does it, whether they're a greeter, whether they're in charge of the food for the night. We always have a meal and refreshments. You know, whether they're just a helper, everybody participates in this. So we've been very happy with the way it's been going.
Right. Let's talk to Marie, who's giving us a call from Hyannis. Hi, Marie.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
There might be a problem.
Yeah, we can hear you.
Okay. I was calling to say that I have been clean and sober for 39 years as of October.
Wow, good for you.
So I just wanted to tell people that, because it does work. You can stay
that is wonderful.
Drugs and alcohol for a lifetime. But as people say, this is a chronic illness. And just because you don't use drugs anymore or drink doesn't mean that you're immune
yeah.
to the problems of the disease. And that 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, you're still vulnerable.
Yeah. Good point, Marie. Yeah. Yeah. Thanks for calling and congratulations on your 39 years. And she's right. This is something that
is
a lifelong thing you have to think about.
It requires long-term treatment. And I think what we're looking at is a real need to have like long-term programs. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's so important that, like we talked about, is the whole family also gets support.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about that. You mentioned that the Drop-In Nights families are also welcome. What if you, it's families and they have a loved one who's unwilling to admit they have a problem? That can be a difficult situation.
It can be. We actually, I don't think, experienced that yet.
Well,
though.
You know what's very helpful about the drop-in night is that we have people there. A lot of them are in recovery themselves. Mm-hmm. So since they've been there, they can speak to people coming in who may be ambivalent mm-hmm. about treatment and share really what it would be like for them to be able to live the life that they really want to live.
Mm-hmm. I think it's a pretty open and warm environment. So people are very open. Sometimes when we're out with a big group, they're a little too open. So we bring them into, you know, a side room to talk more privately because they are finally, okay, I can talk to someone and not feel judged.
That someone understands yeah. what they're going through.
Yeah. That's a good point. You just said that they don't feel judged.
Yes.
And yeah. we talked about, and we heard Lisa talking earlier, that she felt shame. What kind of mother am I that my son would be a drug addict? And mm-hmm. and the isolation of not wanting anybody to know and keeping it secret. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure there are a lot of other families that feel that same way. And it is all about judgment, isn't it?
It is. Many people don't seek treatment due to judgment. They feel ashamed going into a doctor's office or trying to get help because they feel like people make them feel lower and not good enough. And then they just keep using because they're isolated. When people feel empowered, they do so much better. And this is an empowering environment, the drop-in night. So mm-hmm. they come in, they can talk about it, and then we can help them get the support, the treatment they need.
And I guess this goes back to that stigma again.
Yes.
And,
yes. Yes.
and this isn't just stigma among the general public. There's actually stigma in the profession itself. Jenna, I'm going to put you on the spot here mm-hmm. a little bit. But when you decided to go into addiction treatment as a nurse, somebody said to you, that's not real nursing.
Yes. So I was an LPN for many years. And right before I went into nursing school, I read a book on a journey through recovery and then actually overdose and death because of how this woman was treated in her treatment. So I knew I wanted to work in addiction treatment. When we did a roundtable the first day of my RN program, they went around and asked me, what do you want to do? And I said, I want to be an addiction treatment nurse. And the professor said, that's not real nursing. You need to go into a field that actually uses your skills. I don't care how many IVs someone can put in. Nursing is compassion and understanding, mm-hmm. and that's what addiction treatment is, yeah. compassion, understanding,
exactly.
awareness.
Yeah. So what do we do about this stigma problem? How do we battle that?
Well, I think that we've come a real long way. And as a clinician myself for going on 25 years, people were always afraid to even give their name, like we talked mm-hmm. about. And I think we've really come a long way, and I think we'll continue to make steps toward fighting this stigma and by creating more opportunities where there is a judgment-free mm-hmm. place and that people begin to understand that addiction is a disease of the brain.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I think, too, hearing people's stories, like people like Lisa Hillman, who wrote the book about her son, people see themselves in some of these stories. So it's important, I think, for people to share their stories, because this could be anybody, any family.
Yes, yeah. definitely.
So what advice do you have for families who are concerned for the safety of a loved one, the fear that they may overdose? I mean, certainly a lot of family members who are fearful of that.
Narcan training to start. I think more people that have Narcan and understand the use, the better off. Even if you're just walking through a Walmart parking lot and you see someone, it's helpful for everyone to have. And then also to reach out and ask for support, not to know where to go. That mm-hmm. is huge. Or just to ask anyone, you mm-hmm. know, the more awareness we spread, the better off everyone is.
Right. Jamie's giving us a call from Hyannis. Good morning, Jamie.
How are you doing today?
Good.
My thing that I'm going through right now, mine started with Percocet use with injuries with sports, and I got a hold of it. I got into different kinds of drugs, but some of the hang-ups that I found out that possibly you guys could help out, I'm having a huge problem with mass health right now. I must have answered, like, a question wrong or something like that. And it's been, like, I'm on Suboxone now. It's been, like, a month, and now I'm in, like, the waiting period. I send all the faxes in. I went to the community health center. The computers were down the day I went in to speak with a, I forget what it's called. It's a mass health person that.
Yeah, Jamie, it's frustrating. I know that all this paperwork and Jen sort of alluded to that a few minutes ago. And I would say go back. The computers aren't down every day.
Yeah,
go
right.
back.
Or, come back. Keep going back until it's set. There is someone there to help you, though. So certainly go back, get the help. Feel free. You know where to go. Just put your name on the clipboard, and they'll help in any way they can.
Or he could stop in. Tuesday night's our next drop-in night, September 5th, from 4 to 8, and there'll be people there at the Community Health Center, 107 Commercial Street, Mashpee, and he can get help then.
Yeah. At the top of the show, we mentioned that on Tuesday, Attorney General Jeff Sessions called drug overdose deaths the top lethal issue in the U.S. What we didn't mention was his follow-up when he urged law enforcement and social workers to, quote, create and foster a culture that's hostile to drug use. What are your thoughts about that?
So I take a very medical, it's a medical approach. I think having a hostile environment for any type of disorder is incorrect. You need to spread awareness and understanding and approach addiction treatment with awareness and understanding and not make people feel judged. If you create a hostile environment, people are much more likely to keep using because they'll actually fear getting treatment. It'll be that much harder for them to gain employment, to maintain licensure, to get to jobs. If we really take a punitive approach or a hostile approach to addiction treatment, we're going about it the completely wrong way.
Mm-hmm. Gail, do you agree with that?
I just feel this is too important an issue to make it a political.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Something else I wanted to mention that Lisa quickly in our last minute or so, she mentioned with her son not to have expectations. I think she said now she has hope, and she hopes really that he'll just remain healthy. You're both nodding. Yes. That's a good approach, you think?
Yes.
Yeah.
It's a chronic relapsing brain disease, and some people get it and they stay abstinent, but if they do relapse, it's just building off that and understanding they can gain abstinence again.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
There's always hope.
Yeah. And when you think about it, when you quit any kind of, like smoking, the first time isn't always.
No, and it's okay because people do relapse, but there is help available. Mm-hmm. And
Gail Wilson, Health and Human Service Director of Town of Mashpee and Chair of Mashpee's Substance and Task Force. Jen Monahan, Addiction Program Coordinator at the Community Health Center of Cape Cod. Thank you both for being here. The Substance Use Drop-In Nights are the first Tuesday of the month. The next one will be next Tuesday, September 5th, at the Community Health Center of Cape Cod in Mashpee, 4 to 8 p.m. They are free and open to everyone. We'll have a link with more information at our website, capeandislands.org. I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.